4 WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Supporting WGTD is the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're hearing from two fine musicians today. First, a concert pianist on the faculty of Beloit College. And in the second part of the program, a talented high school student who plays the cello brilliantly and will perform this weekend with the Racine Symphony. Here's part one of today's program. That is the opening to one of the most beloved and impressive of all piano concertos, the Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor, Opus 18, by Sergei Rachmaninoff. And this is a work that is going to be performed this coming weekend, this Saturday evening, by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. And in the spotlight as the piano soloist, David Newman, who is on the music faculty at Beloit College, and someone who has played with the Lake Geneva Symphony before. I believe the last occasion was several years ago when he gave what I'm told was a dazzling account of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And now we'll be back to play this gorgeous work by Sergei Rachmaninoff. And we have David Newman with us on the telephone for the next few minutes to talk about his life with the piano, and to talk about this this masterwork, which he will be playing Saturday evening. David Newman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's very nice to be here.
I'm really happy to make your acquaintance and happy to talk with you not only about your career, but about this work, which is one of my very, very favorites. So I'm delighted by this opportunity. From reading your biography, it looks like you got a very, very early start on the piano. Tell us just how long or how young you were the first time you began tinkling the ivories, as they say.
Well, you know how family stories go, the kind of the stories that you hear at Thanksgiving. I was always told and embarrassed by the stories of me playing at a very young, precocious age. I have three older siblings that all took piano lessons, and one of the rules in the house was that we could never play the music of our siblings. You always had to play your own music. So one day when my sister, who was 11 years older, came home and heard someone playing her pieces, she was incensed and stomped through the house only to see me standing in my sleeper, tinkling away at 3 years old, the pieces that she was playing. Clearly, I had heard them so often that I was playing them by ear. So she was stopped dead in her tracks. She couldn't really very much yell at me. She thought it was one of my older brothers.
Wow, very good. I happen to be someone who loves to play by ear, and I'm grateful to have the ability. I'm not saying I ever did what you did, but I do love to play by ear, and in some respects have probably found it a little bit of a hindrance in terms of more serious piano pursuits. That is, it was so fun and so easy to play by ear that I've found myself sometimes frustrated if confronted by notes on the page that I was supposed to play exactly as they appeared and practice that those scores.
Well, you
did
know,
you find that
have,
at all for
I,
you?
I don't actually, but I know what you're talking about. I have a lot of students, and especially adult students, who come to me and complain of that very thing. Actually, I think that the ability to hear and to play by ear can be harnessed well as an accent to learning serious music, and actually an aid to the reading. I mean, hopefully by at some point you learn the basics of reading, but then as you get older, you learn to what my teacher used to call hearing. The music was in the ear of the composer. And that if you can hear it and then you can play it. I mean, it's more involved than that, but essentially you need to be able to hear what it is that you're playing. Otherwise, it just doesn't quite come out quite right.
Well, it sounds like you grew up in a very musical household, a very musically inclined family. Was music, as you were growing up, very much kind of the predominant force in your life, the thing in which you poured out all your energies?
No, there was a real balance. I did all the things normal kids do. I did not have that prodigy life where going off to music camp. I went to scout camp and played baseball and did all the things that normal kids do. So I didn't get serious about playing the piano until much later, junior high and high school.
And what in particular prompted you to get serious? I mean, was it that you started to realize you had an exceptional gift, or was it kind of the galvanizing influence of somebody in your life? What got you serious and in a sense more focused on piano?
I don't think I would have called it a gift, and I certainly wouldn't have recognized it as one at the time, but it did certainly seem to come easily. That much I knew. And there was nothing else that really ignited my interest and passion as much as music. It was something I never got tired of listening to and playing. It was something I was very much drawn to, and the piano was the instrument that was of interest. I did also play trombone in my school bands, but that was, you know, because I needed a trombone player. so I really had much more interest in fun playing the piano.
So explain kind of the where your piano studies ended up taking you. It's quite an interesting story.
Well, when it was time to go to college, again, because I didn't have that prodigy early background, I really wasn't. I wasn't at the level to go to a place like Juilliard or Curtis or New England Conservatory or a place like that. So I went to a smaller music school in upstate New York called the State University of New York at Fredonia, which turned out to be the best thing I could have done. I studied with this phenomenal teacher, Phyllis East, and she was able to bring me up to speed, so to speak, in a really short amount of time. And she had the patience that I think a conservatory teacher at Juilliard or someplace like that probably wouldn't have had with me. So I was very lucky to encounter her and have her guidance. After that, then I felt ready to go on to some of the bigger schools and get some of that training. So I went to study with her teacher, Ted Lutzen, at the University of Michigan. But I was only there a short while when I won a scholarship to the Guildhall School of Music in London, and there studied with two more teachers, Edith Vogel and Joan Havel. Joan Havel was a student of Nadia Boulanger. So I was getting a pretty well-rounded experience of hearing all these different influences. And then when I came back to the U.S., I decided to take up my studies with Ted Lutzen again, only this time he had transferred and started a doctoral program down at Rutgers, which was fine with me. It was near New York City, and so I moved there and continued my studies with him. After that, I moved to Chicago and was ready to start playing professionally rather than studying. So, and as is often the case, you'll hear people say, you often learn even more when you're out there having to actually do it. So I snatched up every opportunity that came along, met with a lot of the, played for a lot of players of the Chicago Symphony, and it was a very fun, exciting experience, and well, I could go on and on, but anyway, that now I'm here in this quieter town of Beloit, and teaching at the college, and loving this time of my life.
You're certainly at a beautiful place. The campus of Beloit is exceptionally lovely, and
it is.
And it sounds like you are enjoying this life that that features quite a bit of teaching. From early on, did you think that serious teaching would also be a part of your own future?
Hadn't occurred to me early on, but from the time between my undergraduate and graduate school years, that was when I started to take on students. And it's an interesting thing that when you begin teaching, all of those things that you were told, all of a sudden, the most important ones sort of sift to the top, and you realize that you are reinforcing the things. You're almost like teaching yourself as you're teaching others. And this is why when I have an older student who is coming along and becoming a little more advanced, I encourage them to teach whoever, their younger siblings, their friends at school, because I'm hoping that the same thing will happen to them. And my colleagues, when we're collaborating in chamber music or something, and we're having a tricky spot in the music, we'll often joke and say, you know, if I just did the things that I tell my students to do, I'd be so much better.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with David Newman, who is a member of the music faculty at Beloit College, and he is about to perform as piano soloist with the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra for their concert that is coming up this Saturday evening at 7:30 at Calvary Community Church. He will be playing the second piano concerto of Sergei Rachmaninoff, which we're going to talk about in just a moment. So, Professor Newman, I imagine in a sense, you prize and treasure these kind of opportunities very, very much when a lot of your time is now taken up with teaching, to, in a sense, be able to shift back into this mode where you're not listening to someone else, but it's you delivering the music yourself. Talk about what these kind of opportunities mean to you, and in particular, getting to collaborate with a group like the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra.
Well, you know, as in so many things, it really comes down to the people. When David first approached me about playing the concerto with the symphony, I thought this would be wonderful because I really admire David Anderson's style of conducting, and he's also a wonderful pianist himself. But I knew working with him would be a great experience. It was just as a matter of choosing which piece to play. So we got together and we talked about it, and I had a few ideas, and I think in the back of his mind, he was pretty settled on the Rachmaninoff. So I sort of went through my suggestions, the Rachmaninoff being one of them, and his eyes sort of lit up and said, yes, that would be okay. And so it's been a nice collaboration. We worked on the Liszt E-flat a few years ago, and we played some two piano things together. We played a Brahms transcription of a movement of his piano quintet. And having him here for several years ago, we were able to just talk music. And so we sort of know how each other thinks, which goes a long way.
Of course.
So it's not just a matter of I'm looking always for opportunities to play, but when the right opportunity comes along, and this certainly was one, yes, I do jump at that.
I want to play the very opening of the second movement, the Adagio Sostenuto, which is, of course, exceptionally lovely, and then invite you to just say a word about the circumstances under which this work was created by Rachmaninoff. So first, just a few moments of the opening of the second movement. Again, this is the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. ¶¶ I'm not sure there's any music more exquisite for piano and orchestra than the opening to this second movement of the Rachmaninoff. Professor Newman, what do you want to say about this piece?
Well, the story that you usually will read in the liner notes of any CD or album cover will tell you that at this time in his life, Rachmaninoff had been suffering what they used to call melancholia. I guess we would call it depression nowadays. And he had completely lost his confidence. And you can see this in many of the letters that he had been writing at the time. And apparently he took advantage of what we would call, I guess, a psychoanalyst at this point, and talked to this person. This was in the early days of psychoanalysis. And after a while, he seemed to come out of his funk and sat down and wrote this piece. So he sets the sort of the summation that you'll usually read when you read the liner notes, which is where there's a lot of there's a wealth of information of music history. If you're not into reading serious music history books, definitely read the liner notes of CDs. You can learn a lot from them.
Right. And I should think that for you as the soloist, this is one of those sort of dream works, because you get to do some kind of big thundering passages, and you also get to play passages like that one. I mean, in a sense, a pianist really gets to demonstrate the full breadth of their abilities.
Oh, it's a perfect concerto. It's just like you said. It's incredibly beautiful, heartbreakingly beautiful in places, and then powerful beyond. It's a very satisfying concerto. He knows exactly how to stretch out for just long enough, and then, you know, gives you the satisfaction at the end. So it's a very, very crowd-pleasing piece. It's very listenable. You know, for those people who may be on the fence about classical music, this is one of the ones that you would like.
Right, absolutely. And I should think, as a romantic work where there is a lot of ebb and flow, it also becomes a really satisfying challenge to put this together with an orchestra and with a conductor. And fortunately, as you were saying, you have a very close musical affinity with David Anderson, the conductor.
Absolutely, yes. If you're a lot of these things, like with any piece, if they're played at too far off a tempo that works, they can just be deadly, or they can be unplayable. You know, there's a margin in which you need to be. And there, you know, you'll hear a variety of different tempos depending on who you're hearing playing. But too fast or too slow doesn't work.
Right. Well, I suspect it's going to be just right Saturday evening. The Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra under David Anderson, with David Newman performing the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2, along with the Symphony No. 2 of Alexander Borodin. For more information, you can go to lakegenevaorchestra.org or call 262-359-9072. The concert is Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m. at Calvary Community Church. David Newman, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a pleasure to make your acquaintance, and we wish you well with this collaboration and all of your future musical exploits.
Greg, it was a pleasure talking to you, and thanks so much for the opportunity.
It's 8:29, and you are listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Greg Reberg, and here's part two of today's program. That is stirring music of Czech composer Antonin Dvorak. It is the opening movement of his Cello Concerto in B minor, Opus 104, one of the great monumental works in cello repertoire. And on the upcoming concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, their masterwork season finale, Saturday evening, 7:30 at Francis Bedford Concert Hall at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, you get to hear the opening movement of the Dvorak Cello Concerto, played by a very talented young cellist by the name of Matthew Udry. I should say first that Matthew's father, Stephen Udry, is a history professor at Carthage College and has been on the morning show on a number of different occasions. I think this is Matthew's first visit to the program, as far as I can recall. But I've known Matthew for a few years, chiefly because I've had the pleasure of playing piano for him as his accompanist on a couple of different occasions, including at least one competition that he won as a very, very young man. And now as a junior at Tremper High School, he has won first place in the most recent Racine Symphony youth auditions, which affords him, among other things, the honor of playing with the Racine Symphony for Saturday night's concert, a concert which will also include Franz Joseph Haydn's delightful Symphony No. 94, affectionately known as the Surprise Symphony. But we're going to spend most of the time that we have together talking with Matthew about his life with the cello and about this incredibly beautiful music by Antonin Dvorak that he is going to be performing on the stage of Francis Bedford Concert Hall this Saturday evening. Matthew Udry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. I was going to say thanks for making time in your busy schedule, but we are recording this on Friday the 31st, which is apparently a day off for you from school, and so you were sitting around with nothing to do today. So,
yep.
But nevertheless, thank you for choosing to join me here. So let's start with a fairly mundane question, but it's certainly an important question to ask. You and the cello, when did this begin? When is the first time you held a cello in your hands?
First time I started cello, I think I started cello around the summer of after third grade. So I've been playing cello for about 7 years now. And it was through my our school district's music program. So everybody, they brought in a bunch of string instruments and everybody got to try, everyone. And at first I actually really wanted to play the violin, but after holding it and hearing really high notes right next to my ear, I decided to give cello a shot instead, and I've stuck with it ever since, and I absolutely love it.
Wow. Your older brother, Justin, is I remember his name correctly,
mm-hmm.
Was a crackerjack saxophone player. Did you think about at all following in his footsteps playing a wind instrument, or for some reason were you drawn to choosing a string instrument? Any particular reason?
I think maybe at first as just like a young kid, wanting to follow my brother's footsteps, yeah, I think I wanted to choose a band instrument. But I think after starting cello and after finding out how much just I really enjoyed it, how much I just enjoyed playing a string instrument, the sound of it, the repertoire, I decided to stick with it.
Hmm. And of course, the nice thing about playing cello is it allows you to play in an orchestra, and of course, that opens up all kinds of very, very exciting possibilities. So was it love at first hearing, love at first sight in terms of you and the cello? Did you immediately play well? I mean, did it immediately feel comfortable?
I'm not totally sure. I know that when I first started, of course, with every young string player, it's always super awkward. Parents are always complaining about just these awful sounds coming while they're coming from their practice rooms. But eventually, once I started to get the hang of it and once I started to advance a little bit more, started playing little tunes and stuff, I just started to really enjoy it.
Hmm. Who was your first teacher?
My first teacher was Mrs. Kolosowski, who was at, she was part of our school, she was one of our school district's music teachers. I remember she'd come in every week and give everybody little lessons. And I know I'm extremely thankful for her. I think she still plays in the Racine Symphony, actually.
Oh.
And she actually introduced me to Mr. Cook, who's my current teacher. And she really gave me the support that I needed to keep on going with cello and keep on pursuing something that I really enjoyed doing.
Great. So you were a third grader when you started.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same as with violin when a young person starts that you begin playing on an instrument that's not a full-size violin but kind of a miniature violin of sorts? Is that the way it is with cello as well? Is there such a thing as a half-size cello?
There is. I actually did start on a half-size cello. Then eventually, as you grow, you move up to bigger and bigger cellos, which start to sound more like real cellos. I mean, I think my first half-size cello sounded more like a viola because it was so small. Mm-hmm. But I know for people that start really, really young, I know they make cellos up to like 1/8 sizes, and they're just absolutely tiny.
Mm. But probably look like a toy and probably sound like a toy to some extent.
Yeah, it does.
Right. So at some point you gravitated to the real thing, so to speak. And right off the bat, were you also playing in an orchestra? I mean, did your school have an orchestra of sorts?
Sort of, yeah. So we did have kind of like an informal ensemble where maybe for a concert once or twice a year, she'd put all the students together and we'd play a few little pieces. But it was nothing like a big formal orchestra until I moved into middle school, where orchestra was a class actually offered by the school.
And what middle school did you go to?
I went to Lance Middle School.
And your director there was?
That was Mrs. Pytel.
Very good. So at what point did you start to get really serious about this? I mean, thinking that this should be maybe the primary focus of your sort of extracurricular energies, or from the very start, did you have that kind of focus and commitment to the cello that this was really important to you and you really gave heart and soul to it? I mean, right from the start, did you approach it like that?
I didn't take it super seriously at the start. I had it, for me, cello was kind of just a side activity along with just like soccer or whatever after school things I had going on. But around fifth grade or so is when I started with my new teacher, Mr. Cook, which is I started taking lessons in Milwaukee with him, which was a bit of a trek. And that's when things started to feel a little bit more seriously. And I started to take cello a little bit more seriously. And it just kept on going up from there. And now,
yeah, I suppose that is that's a big step when you're climbing in the car and making a trip and you're either your mom or your dad or whoever is driving you and you're taking that time. And you don't do that for just something that you feel is kind of an incidental part of your life. You do that when something matters to you, or it helps you understand if something matters to you or not. And it sounds like cello, in a sense, withstood the test or passed the test. You realized how important it was to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As you began studying with Mr. Cook, what were the things that you worked on the most, or what did he seem most anxious to do with you in terms of bringing you to the next level?
The first thing, of course, is technique, because when I started studying with my elementary school teacher, Mrs. Kolosowski, she wasn't actually a cello teacher. She was kind of just a general string instrument teacher. So I think she played violin or viola, and I actually started playing cello kind of like a violin or viola, or Mr. Cook would say, with violin or viola-ish technique. So we spent a while fixing that, but once we started getting more technical things down, I started learning more and more about just music and just the way, just learning less about how to play the music and more of how I should like feel the music, how I should interpret the music. And that's when I really, really started to learn and become really passionate about this.
Right. All along the way, did your mom or dad have to sort of crack the whip to get you to practice, or all along have you loved cello enough that it didn't feel like work, or it was not under duress that you were practicing?
Yeah, I think at first starting, when it's just kind of learning the technique and everything, it's always really frustrating and really hard to do. So I'd never want to practice, and I know my parents would always force me to practice. So I'd always, I got to put in your 30 minutes a day or whatever. But I think eventually when it did get to that point where I started really enjoying the musical aspect of it more and I started to get a better understanding of the music, I think practicing became less of a chore and much more enjoyable thing to do.
I suppose part of it, too, is a lot of that technical work involves things like scales versus versus playing actual pieces, which would be a little bit more fun. Have you, by the way, engaged in other kinds of music making at all? I mean, to any significant extent, have you been a singer or played other instruments? Or for you, is cello pretty much your sole focus in terms of your music making?
I think in terms of music, cello is my sole focus. I know when I was really little, I did dabble a little bit in piano, or I did maybe a bit of the elementary choir. But I think once I was introduced to cello, that started to become the main focus of my music life.
Hmm. How much time have you spent listening to great cellists? Mm-hmm. Or has that not been particularly significant for you? I mean, would you just as soon listen to anything else, but not necessarily listen to a great cellist or watch them on television or something?
I actually spend a good deal of time just listening to a lot of different cellists. Sometimes maybe I'll be studying for a piece or something, or learning a new piece, and I'll go up on YouTube and look up some videos on other cellists doing it. A lot of times, if I don't necessarily have the time to just sit down and listen to an intense piece of music like the 40-minute-long Dvorak concerto, I'll put it on in the background while I'm doing homework or something. So I'm still keeping everything in my ear, kind of in the back of my head.
Very good. As I mentioned in the introduction, I had the pleasure of playing piano for you on a couple of different occasions, including at least one competition that I remember you winning at a very tender age. Maybe you were in eighth grade or something at the time. But do you have vivid memories of the first time you started competing as a cellist and what that felt like to be kind of entering the competitive arena, not, for instance, as a soccer player, but as a cellist?
Yeah.
Did that feel strange at all?
It did, because there's always – it's – competing is a totally different feeling for me than just performing in a recital or something for other people. I think I started competing in middle school, and it's a little bit more intense. There's a lot more pressure because you're walking into this room, and instead of it being like your peers or family members just wanting to hear you play, it's a panel of judges judging how you're going to play. So that's just... that's an extra factor that adds a little more to the pressure.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like it's pressure that you've managed to surmount pretty successfully, judging from all of the successes that you've had and various victories, including the victory this year with the Racine Symphony youth auditions. Tell us how that competition was put together and what unfolded.
So the competition was... it was put together. It was at the First Presbyterian Church in Racine, I think.
Oh, that's a beautiful place.
It is. It's a wonderful building to play in. It's a giant open room. Beautiful place. But the competition, I think it was my third time competing in the Racine competition. And every previous time, I think the first time I didn't place, but last year I got second place. So I felt like entering the competition, there was a bit more pressure to do well, since last year I had done pretty well, but not quite first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little bit more nervous than usual going into this competition, but I think the performance turned out well and everything.
Very good. I was intrigued to see that that second place was also a cellist, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of cool. It was a big day for cellos, and I don't know how much you got to even hear each other, but that probably made you feel good.
Mm-hmm. That's actually my good friend and classmate, Kyle Pearl, who also goes to Tremper.
Ah.
So I was really glad that he was able to make the competition too and do well.
Very good. Before we talk about the Dvorak and Saturday night's concert, first of all, let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Matthew Udry, who is the most recent winner of the youth competition of the Racine Symphony, and he will be playing with the Racine Symphony for their season-ending concert on Saturday, May 8th, at Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Speaking of beautiful places to make music. Ahead of that, Matthew, I want to just have you talk a little bit about the music making you do at Tremper High School, where you are a junior. Say a word about the orchestra program there and about their conductor, Helen Breitenbach Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Well, the orchestra program at Tremper is absolutely fantastic. It's a thriving orchestra community. We have two different school orchestras. We have two after-school orchestras. And we have the Tremper Golden Strings, which you might have heard of, around the Kenosha area. But Mrs. Breitenbach, our orchestra director, just does so much work for us, and she's made the program so amazing. So I'm really thankful for that. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to go to Tremper over other schools, is because of that really amazing orchestra community and music community.
That's great. I'm very much involved in the choral program there, and I also know how vibrant the band program is there. Mm-hmm. So that is just a powerhouse of a school, musically speaking, and also its programs that work together so beautifully. And
yeah.
I like that you've used the term community several times over in talking about the music program at Tremper. That's very, very fitting. So at what point did you begin working on this Dvorak cello concerto, the opening movement?
I started working on Dvorak a while back, actually. I think almost a year and a half ago. I started working on it for an audition. And then I think when I first started working on it, it was a bit out of my technical range. But after starting it a little bit, my teacher, Mr. Cook, is saying, hey, why not just go all the way, try to finish up the first movement, see where we can go with it. And I've been working on it on and off for about the past year and a half. About the past year and a half or so.
Wow. And so this is going to be a tremendous pleasure for you to be playing it, of course, with orchestra. And I would assume this is the first time that you will be playing this as a soloist with an orchestra accompanying you, is that right? I mean, the Dvorak, at least?
Dvorak, at least, yes. I actually did play with an orchestra once before. I think that was 2 years ago, my freshman year in high school, with the Kenosha Symphony, when I won their competition.
Right.
And it's an absolutely amazing experience. It's totally different from playing with piano, and I'm really looking forward to it.
One of the things that is a hallmark of the Dvorak concerto, and the hallmark of many concertos of the late Romantic period, is that the orchestra has a lot to do.
Yeah,
they're not just sort of subservient accompanists, but they are given all kinds of beautiful music to play and are very much equal partners.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that also makes it an intriguing challenge for you, because it's such a collaborative sort of experience.
Yeah, it's much more, like you said, collaborative with between me and the conductor and the orchestra, and at some points it even feels a lot more like a symphony and something just on like a grander scale than a concerto.
Absolutely, I think that's well put. Let's just listen to the very end of the orchestral introduction that ultimately leads into the entrance of the cello themselves. In this particular recording, it's the great Zara Nelsova who is the soloist. So again, we'll hear a bit of this first movement of the Dvorak Cello Concerto in B minor, Opus 104, which Matthew gets to play with the Racine Symphony Saturday night. I just hate to interrupt such magnificent music. Matthew, you and I are recording this interview on Friday morning, the 31st of March, so just over a week before you will actually be playing this with the Racine Symphony. At this point in time, have you had any rehearsal with the conductor of the symphony, Pasquale Larino, or actually rehearsed with the orchestra yet, or is that still to come?
That's still to come. I will be meeting with Maestro Larino actually this weekend to discuss interpretation and tempos and just figuring out all the logistics of everything in the piece. And then I'll be joining the Racine Symphony in a few rehearsals in the week leading up to the concert on Saturday.
So more than once, that's a relief to hear.
Yeah.
And that should be great fun and should be a great pleasure. Do you think very much, and have you and your teacher talked very much about the challenge of playing over an orchestra?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of simply being heard and of the solo cello being very potent with this large orchestral sound behind you.
Yeah, it's definitely much more difficult because the cello is kind of a middle to lower range instrument, so that kind of puts it in the middle of all the orchestral sounds. So it's harder for it to actually come out of an orchestral texture, and unlike a violin or something where it can just soar above everything else.
Mm.
It's not quite the same on the cello. So, yeah, it is a bit more of a challenge to try to be able to project over everything, to try to be able to be heard even over some thickly orchestrated parts. But I think it really helps that Dvorak orchestrated this really, really well for a cello concerto, and that it makes it a little bit easier, that I'm not fighting too much to be heard over the orchestra.
Well, and of course, that's nice because, of course, you want it to be not just loud playing, but beautiful, expressive playing. And that has to be a relief to know that you won't be fighting the orchestra all the way. But on the other hand, you get the pleasure of really playing out with a big, rich, robust sound, which I suspect is also pretty fun. So you will be playing this first movement of the Dvorak. I'm curious, have you explored much of the rest of the concerto? It has three movements in all.
I have. I've done nothing formal. I haven't done any performances of them, but I have always looked at the second and third movements. I think it's always good to do that just to get a really good grasp of the piece and how the first movement fits in with everything else. But yeah, I have looked at them a little bit, and they're absolutely beautiful. I wish I could play those too, but that's almost 40 minutes of music, which would be a lot of work to play with an orchestra.
Right, absolutely. Well, I suspect your day will come. I certainly hope you will have that pleasure at some point to play this amazing work in its entirety. By the way, you mentioned earlier, and I know for a fact that at least once upon a time, you were a really, really fine soccer player, as was your older brother, as was your dad, actually. Is soccer still in the mix, or has cello crowded that out of the picture for you?
Unfortunately, no. Soccer is not in the mix anymore. I think in the past few years, cello has really picked up to the point where it's hard to have a lot of other serious commitments, especially high school soccer, where you're doing several hours of practice after school every day. And I think in addition to that stuff, it was too much, which is something that soccer is something that I really miss, but I do love doing everything that I do with the cello.
Right. So it's probably a difficult decision, but it sounds like a decision you could make with real clarity. You feel good about this decision, and soccer will still be there at some point in your life, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course.
What are your hopes in terms of once you have graduated from Tremper High School? Have you thought very much about that and how cello you hope will fold into whatever that future aspiration might be?
Yeah, I have thought a lot about that, but I'm still not entirely sure what I'll do. I'm not sure if I'll go to music school or a formal conservatory for cello performance or something, but I'm trying to figure out, you know, what way I could still incorporate cello into my life and how it could still be a large part of my life, even if I'm not necessarily going to become a professional musician, which is why I'm really thankful to have opportunities like this with the Racine Orchestra, because it's a really great community orchestra for people that not necessarily want to be professional musicians or not everybody in it is a professional musician, but it's people that it's filled with people that are just really passionate about music, and maybe they can't dedicate their lives to playing in a professional orchestra. So I'm hoping that sometime in the future I can be able to join orchestras like Racine Orchestra.
Well, I can imagine that would give you great pleasure, and any orchestra fortunate enough to have you in their ranks. And in the meantime, we're certainly excited for this opportunity you have to play something as beautiful as this Dvorak Concerto, its first movement with the Racine Symphony. We want to remind our listeners that the concert in question is coming up on Saturday, April 8th, 7:30 p.m. at the beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. The Racine Symphony's masterwork season finale, which will also include the Haydn Symphony No. 4, the famous Surprise Symphony. And you can go to the symphony's website, racinesymphony.org, if you want more information about Saturday night's concert. In the meantime, we're going to listen to the stirring final measures of this opening movement. And Matthew Udry, I want to thank you for joining me today on the morning show. It was great to catch up with you, and I congratulate you on your victory and wish you well with all that is stretching ahead for you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And here's a bit more of the Dvorak. My thanks again to both cellist Matthew Udry and pianist David Newman for joining me today on today's morning show. So lots of great music going on this weekend. We should also mention that if choral music is more your thing, that the Gabriel Fauré Requiem is going to be performed Saturday night at 7:30 at Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage College, featuring Carthage's own Philharmonic Orchestra, along with the Carthage Choir and the top choir from Indian Trails High School. Tomorrow on the morning show, war historian Robert Leplander, who now makes his home in Waterford, and he is one of the experts who is featured in a superb three-part documentary that airs this weekend on the PBS series American Experience, a documentary called The Great War. That is how the First World War used to be referred to. It was thought to be the war that might end all wars, which of course it did not. It certainly transformed the way in which war was waged, and it was an incredibly terrible conflict, creating carnage like the world had never seen. And Robert Leplander is one of the experts on hand to help bring this conflict alive. The documentary airing roughly on the 100th anniversary of America's entrance into the First World War. So you'll hear my conversation with him on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult.